the curtain rose on a period of repression. By the end of the century, Muslims were being taxed beyond endurance to finance a crusade against Islam in the Holy Land. Reduced to abject poverty, they revolted, but were crushed by the new ruler of Sicily, the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick II. Perversely, Frederick had a passion for Arabic culture, and even as he was driving the Muslims from Sicily, he was amassing a vast library of Islamic learning. His librarian was none other than Michael Scott, the British scholar who had translated Arab texts in Toledo. Scott brought to Palermo a prized manuscript by Averroes, a work destined to set Europe ablaze. By 1222, Frederick's campaign to expel the last Muslims from Sicily was reaching its climax.
This beautiful landscape leads to an area called Rocca d'Entella, and it's there where the Muslims had their last stronghold before Frederick II took it over and finally expelled all the Muslims from Sicily. I'm going to meet a man there called Alessandro Coretti, who's an archaeologist who's been studying and excavating the site, and I want him to tell me about what remains here of the Muslim presence and what in fact happened to the Muslims once they were kicked out. Alessandro.
Hey, Raggy, how are you?
I'm good. Tired.
Of course, come up here.
But, I mean, it's stunning. It's absolutely beautiful.
It's fantastic.
It really is fantastic up here. And you can see the full panorama for miles and miles.
And you can control Western Sicily from here.
Really?
Here we are at Entella in a very strategical situation inside the western part of Sicily.
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion, this is the palace of Ibn Abbad, but you don't know nothing about Ibn Abbad.
I've only read very generally, but tell me the story of Ibn Abbad.
It is an interesting story because he was in fact the last Muslim ruler in Sicily.
Right.
You know Ibn Abbad. He formed a state, an independent state, here in the heart of Western Sicily, you see. This was, in fact, the last stronghold of independent Muslims in Sicily.
Why did Frederick want to drive them out?
He would never admit that a Muslim state could exist here in Sicily. On his point of view, they were simply rebels.
Right.
And so, with like every rebel, they had to be subdued. You know that Frederick II attacked in 12 from Monte Iato and defeated Ibn Abbad and his army. And we made a survey in this area, and other scholars did, and all of us found that after the time of Frederick II, all the plains that you can see from here were emptied. No one more lived there.
Alessandro and his team discovered the final resting place of the last Muslims of Sicily on this hilltop. The battle for Rocca d'Entella had ended in slaughter, but Frederick II, who'd organized this massacre, was also responsible for preserving and spreading Muslim culture to cities as far away as Paris.
As the Muslims here in Sicily were fighting what would turn out to be their last fight, in Northern Europe another battle was about to take place. But this time it was a battle over ideas, and it would be sparked by the writings of a Muslim from Cordoba who would launch Paris as the intellectual capital of Europe.
The work of Averroes from Cordoba, translated by Michael Scott, arrived in Paris in the 13th century. This was the real start of Europe's classical revival, and it was 200 years before the Renaissance began.
An ungodly hour of the morning, and I'm trying to get my flight to Paris. Where's the departure gate? But first of all, I've got to check in.
Sicily was a new experience. This had been my first trip, in fact. Paris, on the other hand, I know pretty well. I'd been a student there in 88, but I haven't been back for ages. My first appointment is with a historian of philosophy at the mosque on the edge of the old Latin Quarter. And now I know why it's called the Latin Quarter. In the 13th century, they all spoke Latin there. The mosque here in Paris is not that old. In fact, it only dates to the 1920s, but it's built in a style that I'm told is very reminiscent of the mosques of Al-Andalus. The courtyard and how it's designed, the pillars and the ornamentations, and of course the formal gardens, the very beautiful formal gardens back in those courtyards over there. And the reason why I'm here is that I'm meeting Maria Menacor from Yale University.
Paris becomes the intellectual capital of the Western world when the great works of Greek philosophy are translated out of the Arabic, in which they had been studied for hundreds of years, are translated into Latin and make their way to Paris. And, you know, Paris becomes the place where Christianity has to come to terms with the reintroduction of this scientific, Aristotelian body. It's not so much a body of knowledge, it's a way of approaching the universe, the faith versus reason thing. And Averroes did a line-by-line commentary on the key Aristotelian texts that become practically sacred texts to these intellectuals in 13th century Paris.
But this particular moment where Averroes, right, from Cordoba meets up with the ideas of Aristotle, now what did he do and what did he spark?
He was providing a series of commentaries on Aristotle that argued in Aristotelian terms, but by a man who at the same time considered himself to be a true believer, that you could hold both beliefs at the same time. So, in other words, it's something that is often referred to as the double truth principle, i.e. that I can believe what my faith teaches me, and I can also believe what that, I mean, in our time would be what that particular, microscope says, or that observation, or in that laboratory, even if those two, on the face of it, contradict each other.
Averroes was trying to diffuse a conflict between science and religion because the truth revealed by science was often at odds with the truth of divine revelation. But this attempt at reconciliation had the opposite effect when his ideas came to the attention of the Christian Church. They immediately banned his works and those of Aristotle. The intellectuals of Paris fought back and a debate raged on for years. Today, France is trying to keep religion out of public life. A law recently passed here bans all religious symbolism inside schools and workplaces, and that includes the hijab, a head covering that some religious Muslims believe women must wear. And I'm noticing a different atmosphere on the streets of Paris to the one I knew as a student. There's tension here. Khalidi, first of all, I want you to describe to me, how is the situation in France for Muslims living here?
You feel that there is a big problem really in the society. There is a big change in the mentality. You feel it in the street, you feel it in the metro. If there is a bump in one place, Like, for example, in Spain, when you went in the metro, you feel that everybody looking to you, okay? You will search what you have, okay? Many questions. You feel that there is a change for the Muslim living in Europe.
You're a student of medieval Islamic history. When you look at this mixing of the two cultures, two religions, and it shows you that there hasn't been a clash in history, do you think that that is a model that can work for today?
Yes, and I think that today it's urgent to return to this glorious period, society living together, okay, in the same area, the three religions together. There is liberty of expression. They have the right to say what they think. We cannot progress without an idea about your identity and your culture and your history.
There's a venue in Paris specifically for the study of Islamic culture and history, the Institut du Monde Arabe. The building is a modern interpretation of the architectural traditions of Islam. The facade reflects the sky, just like the pool at the center of the Alhambra. Unfortunately, I'd been in Palermo when George Saliba from Columbia University in New York gave a lecture here. George is famous for his passionate and persuasive arguments about the impact of Arab scholarship on the Renaissance. And I couldn't believe my luck when George agreed to do the lecture again, just for me.
What I'd like to talk about today is the relationship between Arabic science and the science of the Renaissance. Now, I want you to look at the drawing that you see here on the left, which is taken from Gray's Anatomy, of how the ancient Greek text conceived of the process by which the human body cleans the blood. Galen tells us, and Galen, by the way, is the major Greek figure. Galen tells us the left ventricle inserts the pneuma, i.e. this vital spirit, into the blood. It cleans it and it pumps it through the rest of the system. This is how the work, the blood is cleansed. This physician by the name of Ibn al-Nafis that we see here, who was writing about the year 1241, and he says there is no such passage between the two ventricles of the heart. For in that position, the heart is a very solid muscle, and hence it is impossible for the blood to go through a mysterious passage. The only way for the blood to be cleansed is to go up through the lungs and then come down from the lungs to the left ventricle, and hence we have the first discovery of what we call the pulmonary circulation of the blood. The main purpose of this activity is not to just be kind to the Islamic civilization or to the Arab civilization for producing this fantastic results that the Renaissance made use of, but I think the more important part is to do the history of Western science properly, to understand the developments of Western science itself for the sake of understanding the intellectual history of Europe itself. People have not been looking. That's the trouble. Klein is the source of everything, was already reformed, was already critiqued, and alternative science was already built into the Islamic world. Hence, a Renaissance person would have thought about Arabic science as being the latest state of the art, so to speak. This is not the only place. This is.
It was a marathon, but George was determined that I'd leave his lecture convinced that Arabic science had made a major contribution to the Renaissance. And it worked. But it has to be said that Arabic science today isn't living up to its glorious past. And in the Middle East, faith versus reason has again become a burning issue.
How are you?
I'm good.
How are you?
Yeah? Wow, what is
he? I know. Well, you're on YouTube right now.
Yeah, okay.
So. How are you?
All right, this is Magnum. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Khosh Amadid.
My friend, the photojournalist Abbas, has just returned from Palestine. His assignments for the photographic agency Magnum took him to Gaza, one of the most troubled regions in the Middle East today.
And this is all in...
This is all Gaza. This is the latest. This is the latest work. Religion is a dangerous ideology today.
Yeah. Having covered parts of the Middle East, people have asked me, Muslims and people in the West, is Islam and Western values always going to just clash?
Well, I'm not a historian, and I'm not a futurologist.
No, sure.
I'm a photographer. I can tell you what's happening today. I think today religion is becoming more and more important in people's identities. And therefore, religion for them, Islam for them, becomes an ideology. for struggle. Mm. You see? And this is what I mean, you know, Islamism has lost the struggle for control of societies, political control, but it has won in people's minds. Yeah. And that's very important. Look, I mean, in, for instance, in Egypt, nobody dares go to the beach anymore. Women don't dare go to the beach. In Gaza, men go to the beach, swimming trunk. Yeah. Kids do, women no, just, you know, full hijab, and they just went on things. So in a way, they have won in people's minds.
And this picture here is of women in Gaza.
Yeah, it's a young medical student in Gaza, in Al-Azhar University. Mm-hmm. And, when I took the picture, it reminded very much one picture has become a sort of classic. That was 20 years ago.
And this picture here is of medical students in Gaza.
Yeah. That's why as a photographer, I think, you know, as a historian of the present, I think I have a responsibility not to be objective, because I'm a very subjective photographer. You know, I mean, this is not Gaza. This is my Gaza. But I try to be fair.
Abbas, this idea of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism in Europe, in Al-Andalus, and this idea that they tolerated each other, learned from each other, convivencia, as it's known, is that a model that is relevant today?
Honestly, I wouldn't know. What I do know is when you say the word Andalusia to an Islamist, either violent or non-violent, it doesn't evoke the mix of culture and the convivencia, as you say. It evokes losing a battle.
That doesn't come across to me. No one has ever commented to me about it.
Oh, it comes to me a lot, you know, when it's Andalusia.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Convivencia, people living together, yes, fine, it's a model. It might not be adaptable today, it's one thing. But if you're seeing as a defeat, as being kicked out of the country you lived in, is very, very dangerous.
What Spain, Sicily, and Paris have all taught me is that the history of ideas is inextricably woven with the history of conflict. And all too often, only the conflict is remembered, the ideas are forgotten. The people I'd met were trying to keep ideas alive. But now I had to return to Spain, to the last stronghold of Islam in Europe, and the place of final conflict in the story of Al-Andalus, Granada. In 15th century Spain, all that remained of Muslim Al-Andalus was the Kingdom of Granada. It was under threat from the most powerful alliance the Christians had ever mustered, an alliance made in marriage between Queen Isabella and Ferdinand V. This is a description of Granada by a traveller 500 years ago. All the slope where lies that part of Granada is most beautiful, filled with numerous houses and gardens, all with their fountains, myrtles and trees. All of it is lovely, all extraordinarily pleasing to behold, all abounding in water. That's what belonged to 400,000 Muslims inside the city, whose numbers had swelled as other parts of the empire had crumbled and fallen to Christian kings. And that's what the forces of Isabella and Ferdinand, who were gathering on the edge of the city, were determined to take. It's a steep journey down to the Cathedral of Granada, and in the cathedral is a chapel dedicated to Isabella of Castile and Ferdinand of Aragon. Separately, they ruled two powerful Christian kingdoms. Together, they ruled Spain. The cathedral precinct, like in all big cities, is a bit tacky. It's cluttered with souvenir stalls, but it gave me a chance to buy a little gift for my two-year-old son, Sami. This is his name in Arabic. The cathedral, like the Alhambra, is a place of great opulence and craftsmanship, although the styles are worlds apart. This is the royal chapel, built in 1507. It's the final resting place of Ferdinand and Isabella, whose marriage in 1469 united Christian Spain against Boabdil, the Muslim ruler of Granada. In these carvings, the story of their great victory over the Muslims is told.
Ferdinand and Isabella with an army of 80,000 men camped outside the walls for 18 months before the city finally fell in 1492. It's an occasion that's still celebrated in cities and towns all over Spain.
Just past the sign which says Suspiro del Moro, which in Spanish means the sigh of the Moor, or the Moor's last sigh. And legend has it that that's the sound that King Boabdil made as he looked back down towards Granada, seeing it for the very last time. He was given safe passage into exile, but the Muslims he left behind, their ordeal was about to begin. Fiesta is taking place in this piazza. I'm going to try and find somewhere to park. It hasn't begun. Here we go. Hola, hola. Whoa. Okay.
This is the town of Vélez de Benadaya, an hour and a half from Granada. As a war correspondent for 8 years, you wouldn't think I'd be fazed by this.
Never get used to it, and that stench as well.
Woo. But the real action takes place in the town square.
All the kids far prefer to dress up as Moors rather than Christians. They have a hard time convincing the younger boys to dress up as Christians for this battle. And let's face it, a scimitar is more cool than a straightforward sword. Which is probably why.
The Christians are saying that they've given the Moors every chance to live in harmony with them. A little bit of a special statement, perhaps. This is their last chance to live in harmony once and for all. They're giving them an ultimatum.
Ilustre Biblia, tan solo a un amado amorico, solo ceden palmo a palmo, a de los vigías del otro que guardan el castillo.
And what are the Moors saying in response? The Moors are saying that they've been treated poorly forever, and this is a disingenuous offer.
There's no peacekeepers, and negotiations have failed. And I think they're going to reenact now how it was back in the 15th century. That the fact that there'd been this constant rebellion, the Moors had refused to lie low, effectively, to be subservient. And that's just the interaction we've just seen at this castle. That failed, and it was a fight now. And the Christians determined to essentially drive them out, wipe them out. The Muslims had to go.
Let's face it, this is meant to be a fun day out for all the family, not a history lesson. The real story is portrayed on the walls of the Royal Chapel. There was no final assault on Granada. In January 1492, Boabdil, the last Muslim king of Spain, surrendered to Ferdinand and Isabella, because after an 18-month siege, his people were close to starvation. But by handing over the keys to the city, Boabdil secured generous terms from Ferdinand and Isabella. The treaty guaranteed the Muslims freedom to practice their faith and customs. But the Jews were the first to suffer. 4 months after the treaty was signed, they were expelled from Spain, and promises made to the Muslims would soon be broken. In 1502, Ferdinand ordered a mass baptism of all Muslims. Philippe de Vigiani, who carved these panels, was a great artist. You can see the anguish in these faces. This cuts deeply. The Muslims had never forced the Christians to convert. For many, it was too much to bear. Those who wouldn't convert fled into the Sierra Nevada. The next 100 years saw countless skirmishes in the mountains. And this is where the fiesta of Vélez de Benadaya, after 10 hours of celebrations, is reaching its climax.
This is the actual battle scene at the foot of the Arab castle. It's being stormed, and this was the very last sort of refuge, if you like, of the Muslims in this area, before they were effectively driven out at the point of a sword. And I'm being hostage to...
Muere, mi Dios.
I don't know if we...
Muere.
What's really strange about this, and it's kind of sweet in some ways, is that there's a balance, you know, it doesn't... what actually happened in history is not what's being recreated here, because basically the battle is a game of two halves, if you like, and the Muslim win in the morning, and then later on the Christians win in the afternoon, so they're trying to maintain some kind of balance.
For a more accurate version of the final conflict, I have to head deeper into the mountains, a region known as the Albuquerques.
Trying to find the house of... I've got to be careful, very high up. But I'm trying to find the house of... Chris Stewart, who's the author of Driving Over Lemons, the British author, and lives in this region, knows it very well, this area of the Al-Bukhar, and I want to talk to him about its history and what it's like today, because this was the area that the Muslims who left Granada, along with King Boabdil, when Granada fell and was taken over by Isabella and Ferdinand, this is where they sought sanctuary.
This is really rugged terrain. It's hard to believe people could live off this barren land. If I'd known it was going to be this tough, I'd have left the fiesta early.
Hi, Chris. I'm really, really sorry.
That's all right.
I'm appallingly late. Very nice to meet you. Very nice.
If Chris Stewart looks familiar to you, it's because he used to play drums for Genesis. First of all, he wanted to grill me for details about the fiesta in Veleth.
It's not intended today to have a sort of totally derogatory...
No,
it's partly caricature and festive and sort of a bit farcical. It's intended as a farce, a bit of theatre.
But there is a festival. There's Dia de la Toma, which is the 2nd of January.
Right.
They use it as an excuse for any sort of... vicious right-wing fascist politics.
Right.
If you like.
It's
a very unpleasant affair.
That is one hell of a view.
And every day I looked at the same view for 16 years.
For the last 16 years, Chris has struggled to make a new life in the Albuquerques. It's the subject of his bestseller, Driving Over Lemons. His struggle in this wild land led him to explore the story of the Muslims who also sought refuge here 500 years ago.
How did it work out? I mean, after Ferdinand and Isabella had taken Granada, you get an idea that it was a pretty harsh affair.
Well, they certainly weren't as hard on the Moors as they were on the Jews, who were really given their marching orders straight away in a most brutal fashion. To the Muslims, they sort of said, right, well, you can have that barren patch in the mountains over there. And it was less Isabella and Ferdinand than their religious advisor, Carlos Cisneros, who finally put the closing word on convivencia. Cisneros decided that this was not the right thing. He as he founded the Inquisition, he said that good Christians cannot live with infidels. So the Muslims, we must drive them out. And the way that this was done was that laws were enacted which made their lives intolerable here. They were, first of all, they were forbidden to speak Arabic. They were forbidden to practice their religion, obviously. They were forbidden to wear their traditional dress. And one of the more offbeat things is they were expected to eat ham. I'm sure you know that the eating of pig in any form is abhorrent to Muslims.
Yeah.
I've heard it said that each household would have to have its doors open and there would have to be hams hanging up in conspicuous places within the house. So that the ham police who visited, who would be the equivalent of the thought police.
The thought police.
Yes. They were the ham police.
How extraordinary.
Could see that they were eating ham. And if they felt that if they were eating ham, then they'd done the job properly. They'd converted properly to Christianity. So they revolted, like you would. I mean, there was no way for them to go. I mean, everything had been taken away from them. And that's what Cisneros wanted. They rose up and they were defeated at the Barranco de la Sangre, which is there.
That hilltop there?
Yeah, they were defeated by Don Juan of Austria. And apparently in this battle, the extraordinary things of those times, the blood the river of Barranco del Sangre, de la Sangre, which means the Valley of Blood, ran red with blood, but of course the Muslim blood ran downhill and somehow separated from it, the Christian blood ran uphill.
In Granada in 1492, Ferdinand and Isabella were taking steps to ensure that only one faith and one race would prevail in Spain. And although the Muslims had suffered terribly, the Jews fared even worse. The few remaining Jews who'd converted to avoid exile were relentlessly pursued by the Inquisition. Outside Granada Cathedral, on the very spot where Jews were burned at the stake, I met Abahai Abuhab, a Jewish history student, and we watched the Corpus Christi procession together.
In terms of the atmosphere, when you first came here to study, yeah?
And I was overwhelmed. I was living just 2 streets back here.
Really?
And the first procession that just got me as a shock, because it was the patron of Granada, and seeing all these people with the hats that I knew related to the Inquisition, doing penitence for their sin.
You find it a bit...
It was very hard.
Weird.
I know that many of those who accepted Christianity and converted and stayed here were persecuted. And for us, it is, for Jewish people as a whole, it is like a memory. That
of course, a frightening one.
A frightening one, exactly.
Do you think, I mean, people who are here, who come in, and for them it's a fiesta, I mean, do they realize that it does hold frightening memories for people who aren't Christian?
No. I think it was, from collective memory, it was wiped out.
The only remnants of Islamic Al-Andalus in this procession are these giant puppets of Granada's last Muslim rulers, Boabdil and his queen. But of the Jews, nothing remains. And those who converted even lost their identities. They were given Christian names. But to the church, they would always be infidels at heart. So, of course, infidels could have had nothing to do with the greatest moments of Ferdinand and Isabella's reign, the discovery of the New World. All over Spain are monuments to this moment in 1492, when Columbus set out on his first voyage of discovery. This statue in Granada shows Christopher Columbus petitioning Queen Isabella with his audacious plan to travel westwards around the globe to reach the East Indies. This would give Spain an independent trade route to the Orient and break the Muslim stranglehold on trade with the East. En route to the Indies, Christopher Columbus actually discovered America and found a new and greater store of wealth than had ever been seen. American gold transformed Spain into a colonial empire, and all of Europe got rich and powerful by plundering Spanish treasure ships. In the East, it was a different story. The wealth and influence of the Muslims faded. 1492 was effectively the end of one empire and the start of another.
It was when the shape of things that we know today was really cast. East looking east and west looking west. Their backs turned to each other and their relationship marked by alienation and hostility. And that's the world that I've seen reporting from the Middle East. But through this journey, I've seen a very different story. One in which Islam is permanently hardwired into European civilization and helps propel the continent out of the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance. And it's a story in which Muslims, Christians and Jews make advances in sciences and learning, and they do this through tolerance and dialogue.
And no event illustrates this better than the real story of Christopher Columbus. Isabella, in fact, rejected his plan. She was only persuaded by Luis de Santanel, a Jewish convert to Christianity, who interceded on Columbus's behalf. Another Jewish convert, Luis Coronel, the court's Minister of Finance, bankrolled the entire expedition. Columbus studied Arabic maps. He navigated with astrolabes and equatoria, perfected by Muslim astronomers from Toledo. And there was at least one Jewish convert on the voyage. He was Luis de Torres, a linguist. Some say Columbus himself was Jewish. Without Jewish and Muslim expertise, Spain would not have become the greatest colonial power in 16th century Europe. My journey has been about a forgotten history, but really it's a history that's been deliberately erased. And that's because of resentments arising from conflict. if the abiding memory is just, this land was ours, they kicked us out, or the invader took what belonged to us, then contributions to science and culture will be lost. Only the battles will be commemorated. So maybe some things should be forgotten, and then perhaps history will become more than just winners and losers. Some Spanish cities are now removing monuments that celebrate the slaughter of Muslims. In fact, Spain seems to be rediscovering convivencia, the spirit of coexistence which defined Al-Andalus. And by reconnecting with its Muslim heritage, Spain is becoming culturally richer. On my travels, I met this group of musicians whose music celebrates the spirit of convivencia. They say it was never lost because it's preserved in the music of the Middle East and Spanish flamenco.
A private concert. That was amazing. And what were you singing towards the end? There's something about Sudan and Andalusia.
It's like without frontiers, we can meet anywhere. I'm going to pick you up wherever you are.
It's like go and return. Yeah, they go to Spain and return back to part of Sudan. Okay. Yeah.
Es que es como algo. El flamenco tiene una parte escondida, ¿no? De la música andalusí. Tiene tanto que ver una música con la otra. Que son casi como de una familia, ¿no?
You say that flamenco music has a lot to do with Andalusian, Arabic Andalusian music. And it's like they were born from the same father or something like that.
Stay with BBC 4 for topical comedy, like the news, but with laughs. Chris Woodhead joins Marcus Brigstock for the late edition next.